Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 12th of April, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the first podcast of the week, and that means I have with me today my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring to look over the weekend's news. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed, yes. It's been an interesting week, the week that's just gone, actually, and I think we've got some interesting material to discuss.
We certainly have, and we're really going to be talking today about something that has been on the news all over the weekend, and that is the unfortunate passing away of Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. And normally we are quite critical of the royal family. We've been very critical of Prince Harry in particular, and the fact that none of them have really stood up for white people or stood up for the British people. They all seem to be quite happy to have the British people replaced. But Prince Philip has really stood out as being somewhat different to the rest of them. And I can only wonder at what has happened to his children and why they didn't take after him, because he really seems to me to be an archetypal alpha male. And I mean, you can tell that just from the size of him. I mean, he's absolutely huge, and he hasn't shrunk as he got older. I don't know if he's on testosterone replacement therapy or whether he has always been high testosterone. Our testosterone levels have dropped by 20% over the last 20 years. So he's really an example of the last of the alpha males that we see that actually have these high natural testosterone levels. And the things that he's done in his life, how many people have created an entirely new sport? How many people are worshipped as a deity over the other side of the planet? How many people are brave enough to speak to the journalists in the way that Prince Philip has? I mean, just look at the way that they treated Donald Trump when he tried doing the same. He also fought in the war. He was in the Navy. He's actually done hard work in his life. He was also an engineer, spoke lots of different languages. I mean, he was just a good all-round guy. And when you see him today at the age of 99, you can see it in his eyes. He is still as sharp as a razor blade. And you can see he's still enjoying life. And he just seems to me to be a perfect example of an alpha male. And I'm very, very sad to see him go. I'm very glad to see that the television has just been full of talking about his life. It's a great shame they didn't decide to concentrate on him before now, but I guess they may have been waiting another 2 months, because he was 2 months off his 100th birthday, which is quite something for somebody to get to the age of 100, and also for a male to get to the age of 100. So I thought today we could have a little bit of a tribute to Prince Philip and talk about some of the things in his life that maybe the listeners were unaware of. Have you got any thoughts on Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, Max?
Yeah, I get the general idea that he was actually quite a good sort of person. And following on from what you've said, yes, I think he is somebody who performed very well as a sailor and an officer in the Royal Navy. And was mentioned in dispatches during the Second World War. So I think from that point of view, we can have a great amount of admiration for him. And the fact that he did such a lot of work for charity and developed the Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme, which is, you know, quite a unique thing, and hundreds of thousands of young people all around the world compete in order to win the Duke of Edinburgh's awards. I think that there's a lot to admire there in him. He has spent his entire life and devoted his entire life, once he married the Queen, to supporting the Queen in her role. And I think in that respect, he probably has led a more muted life than he otherwise would have done. And I think that he probably had a lot of potential that he could have expanded and developed if he hadn't been in a position where he needed to take a following role. And had he been a man in his own right, I think he probably would have achieved more than he has actually done, which is a shame, you know, that he didn't get to do that. And yeah, I just generally a likable person who had a tendency to make quips that betrayed a sense of humour which wasn't quite politically correct, and that some people liked and other people didn't like. And so a character who we can admire, but who possibly and probably didn't reach his full potential, that's what I would say.
I think I'd agree with all of that. But also the fact that he didn't reach his full potential, he also shows one of the greatest traits that we have, which is humility. And he showed humility in the way that he did take second place to the Queen. He was very humble, while at the same time being in one of these top positions in the land, where unfortunately he wasn't able to make any changes. I mean, they're not allowed to be political, they're not allowed to speak forth on these sort of subjects. So what he did, he spoke forth on the extinction of species. And I so would have loved him to talk about the threat that is actually facing the white race, but I should imagine that was somewhere that he just couldn't go. But he must have been aware of it, because he found it was central to his life was the preservation of the environment. And he refused to be known as a green. He said he certainly was no bunny hugger. And when he started doing all the environmental work, he said more people were writing to him concerned about the way animals were treated in zoos. And what he was concerned about was mass extinctions of species, not so much animals in zoos. If you don't have animals in zoos, then how are people going to really build up an empathy for these creatures? It's very important that we do have these, have them in zoos, and it preserves the species. So he did manage to do something original there. And as you mentioned, these quips that he made, they were fantastic. We'll have a look at some of those later on. I thought we could just have a look at briefly through his early life. And I pulled out some notes from Wikipedia here. Philip was born into the Greek and Danish royal families and was a prince in both. He was born in Greece, but his family was exiled from the country when he was just 18 months old, after Greece failed to defeat the Turks in the Greco-Turkish War. He was smuggled out of the country in a box of fruit by the British and then brought up in France. He always thought of himself as Danish, but he also spoke English, French and German. And I'll just stop there, because during this Greco-Turkish War, his father, who obviously was a prince of Greece, he was a commander on one of these ships. His father saw active service as well. And at the end of the war, they wanted to kill his father, basically. So they had to escape from Greece, smuggling him out. And he always saw himself more as Danish rather than Greek. And he was known as Phil the Greek in some circles, but he preferred to see himself as actually Danish. And he was a genuine prince of both of these royal families. So he was the right person to marry Princess Elizabeth, I think. Max, do you know anything about this Greco-Turkish War? Do you want to comment on this at all?
I don't really know much about the Greco-Turkish War, to be quite honest. Although Greece and Turkey have constantly been at loggerheads at various points throughout history. It's interesting that he was born a prince to a country that once had a great empire and then went into decline and has an empire no more, and that he then came to be married to a queen of a country that had a great empire at the point when he married the queen, but that has since shed its empire, and so it's for him an end to his life, which has some similarities to the beginning of his life.
Similar to the loss of the empire. As I say, I think there's far too few people like him left around. He was one of the last, certainly the last in the public eye. And to think that he saw active service during the war and that he is still alive today and still in the public eye and still really continuing to have the traditionalist mentality that people had during the war, I think he's the very last of them that we will ever see in the public eye. He was always highly intelligent and left France to live with his grandmother in England, going to live at Kensington Palace, while his sisters married SS officers and moved to Germany. His mother was schizophrenic and deaf, and from this time she no longer lived with his father, who moved to Monte Cristo. and his mother spent the last part of her life as a nun and founded an Orthodox nursing order of nuns. So his mother was obviously very into the Orthodox Christianity, the Greek Orthodox Christianity, and he was baptized in that. And later on in his life, he changed to being baptized into the Anglican Church so that he could marry Elizabeth II. And I find it interesting here that his sisters married SS officers, and when he later on, when he was actually in the war, he was fighting against the people who these SS officers were fighting for. So yes, fighting against his own family during the war.
It kind of shows what a turbulent time the middle of the 20th century was, that you could get somebody who was a prince of two European nations, who would have go on to marry the queen of one protagonist nation, whilst his sisters married nobility and SS officers in Germany, the other protagonist. And so it's a very a turbulent time, and it's it makes his life, it adds an additional dimension to his life when you think about the possibilities that could have happened either way, and the fact that he and his sisters took such different paths during that period.
Well, I wonder if he wasn't also interested in National Socialism, to be honest. I suspect he probably had sympathies with them, but fought on the side of the British, the same as the British Union of Fascists. Their members said, "We will fight on the side of the British, but we do not agree with this war." We know that a lot of the aristocracy back then did not agree with the war, and the fact that his sisters had obviously married into the SS, basically, and that that may be why he was then sent to a school that was owned by a Jewish intellectual. You were telling me something about this, Max, before we started, something about his schooling in Scotland.
Yes, I can't remember the chap's full name, but Gordonston is the school that Philip went to, which was, I believe, it was the principal of the school was a chap called Hahn, who was a Jew who had fled persecution in Germany prior to the Second World War. Having said that, that doesn't necessarily mean there's anything wrong with that, because as far as Hahn is concerned, he seems to have had a very individual approach to education. And when you look through the sort of things that the school concentrated on, which was to promote independence of mind, to promote physical health, and lots of the other traits that were common to youth organizations in the early part of the 20th century. So a lot of the ethics surrounding the Boy Scout movement were also incorporated into Hahn's educational system, from what I can see. And so it would appear that Gordonston prepared Philip well, and that during his early life he was firmly of that opinion, because he then arranged for Charles to be educated at Gordonston as well.
He did actually make some comments about Scottish education, saying that it was very harsh, and really only the Scottish were cut out for it. He made a couple of comments about that in the quotations that I saw from him. I didn't actually include those because there were just so many. I had to whittle them down. Well, Philip went on to become a Navy cadet, and he had a talent for engineering. During the war, he was awarded the Greek War Cross, and he worked his way up to becoming one of the youngest first lieutenants in the Royal Navy at the age of 21. During the invasion of Sicily in July 1943, as second in command of the Wallace, he saved his ship from a night bomber attack. He devised a plan to launch a raft with smoke floats that successfully distracted the bombers while allowing the ship to slip away unnoticed. And after the war, he was posted as an instructor at HMS Royal Arthur, the Petty Officers' School in Corsham, Wiltshire. And this is interesting because, I mean, this shows that this wasn't just an ornamental thing. He wasn't just called an officer. He was actually doing the work of an officer, and he worked his way up. So he was the youngest first lieutenant that was there in the Royal Navy, and he actually saw action during the war, and he was given this medal for his action in the war, not simply because he was a Greek prince, but because he actually did this work. And when you think of the rest of the royal family, that they've led quite cosseted lives, really. I mean, even when Harry went out to Afghanistan and went out in his helicopter, I don't think he saw any real action over there. Whereas what you've got here is you've got the prince actually saving the lives of the men on the ship by coming out with this plan to launch this decoy.
Yeah, I know also that during the invasion of Sicily, which was Operation Husky during the Second World War, there was a terrible storm that blew up on the night that the invasion was due to take place. And that the storm was such that many of the ships carrying British troops out to Sicily ended up being blown off course and landing at the wrong pieces of coastline along the southern side of Sicily. Also, there were there was an initial wave of commandos and members of the parachute regiment that were all going to be dropped at key strategic points in Sicily in order to capture various bridges and things of this sort. Lots of them were blown off course by the strong winds that blew up, and the winds were so strong that there was an instance where some of the gliders carrying parachutists were blown so far, of course, that they ended up landing in Malta, and so it's you can envisage a very stormy night at sea when the German bombers were coming over to bomb the British ships that were escorting the troop ships, etc. And you can imagine how effective it would have been actually to distract those bombers by using floats and smoke, so that it would have created a very confusing environment for the German bombers in their attempts to resist the British invasion.
It's another British trait as well, isn't it? Using decoys during the war, as we've seen with quite a few in our Greatest Britain series, trying to make out that there's actually more troops there than there are, or that they've got more weapons than there are. And here they are pretending that it's the ship over there with these smoking rafts rather than the ship getting hit. He and Elizabeth had been exchanging letters since the age of 13, since Elizabeth was 13, that is, and eventually announced their engagement when she was 21. And I find this interesting because they stayed together for 75 years. I mean, he's 99 years old at the moment, and that is a massive length of time for people to stay married for. And we have a really high divorce rate at the moment. And people are encouraged to sleep around. They're encouraged to have different partners and try and pick the one that they want to settle down with. And it never works out. The more partners they have, the more chance there is of the marriage breaking down. And yet when you have a couple that were actually writing to one another when she was at the age of 13, that is a relationship that will last for the rest of their lives when they get married. Which tends to say that we've got it the wrong way round, and we should be encouraging people to get married at the age of 16. We should be saying your first love is who you should marry. You should not be holding out for somebody else. And it really, I mean, the royals are really the last group in society that still have arranged marriages. There are only a certain group of people that he could really pick from to marry, and Elizabeth only had a certain group of people that she could pick from to marry, the same as with Charles and why he was married to Lady Diana, and that they really broke with that tradition with William and Harry. William had actually been with Kate, I think, from an early age, and hopefully that will last, but I can't really see Harry and Meghan's marriage lasting. And you know, I think this is a good thing. I mean, this could be criticized today. They could say, well, Elizabeth was underage, she was only 13, But look, this marriage has lasted for all this time. It's been a successful marriage. Marrying when you are young, I think it's usually successful if the people that are marrying have not slept with anybody else. If they're both virgins when they got married, then they will stay together for the rest of their life. So I think this is a good example of that. You got any comments on that, Max?
Well, firstly, I'd just like to correct you and say it was Edward VIII that first married somebody who wasn't of the approved class, as far as the British royal family were concerned, certainly during the 20th century. But yeah, I think that there obviously was a great attraction between Queen Elizabeth and Duke of Edinburgh when they first met, and that custom of the time of people having fidelity until they actually married, and then being faithful in marriage, that's something which I think is it's sad that we've lost that in a great many cases. Lots of marriages now fail. I think something like about one in two marriages fail now, and that's quite often because people enter into marriage with unrealistic expectations, and I think that probably the one good thing that the courtiers of the time, they were very reserved, and it's been reported they didn't wholly approve of the Duke of Edinburgh when the romance between him and the Queen first surfaced, but the general conservatism with a small c of the royal family is such that those principles of fidelity and lifelong marriage have lasted with the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, and it's something to be admired and something to for younger people to strive to emulate.
Yeah, Edward VIII, he did have to step down, though, didn't he, when he married the American, and actually Prince Philip did make a quip about that. He was responding to somebody, and he said something about some of us have been known to marry chambermaids, and one of us even married an American, which I thought was quite funny. I don't know if Meghan had heard about him saying that one. After his honeymoon, Philip returned to the Navy, at first in a desk job at the Admiralty and later on a staff course at the Naval Staff College, Greenwich. From 1949, he was stationed in Malta after being posted as the first lieutenant of the destroyer HMS Checkers, the lead ship of the first destroyer flotilla in the Mediterranean Fleet. In July 1950, he was promoted to lieutenant commander and given command of the frigate HMS Magpie. And on the 30th of June 1952, Philip was promoted to commander, though his active naval career had ended in July 1951. So he continued in the Navy, working his way up in the Navy in the way that you would expect royalty to do. Don't forget, in the past, royalty always led the army, always led the Navy, led them into battle. And he actually did this. He was there working in the Navy all this time. And whilst he must have been married to the Queen by that time, and yet he was still there working in the Navy, not just going around shaking people's hands or anything like that. Apparently, he used to come out from the castle in Windsor at 10 o'clock every morning and greet people and sort of walk about and say good morning to people. I heard on the news today. Have you got any comments on him staying in the Navy here, Max?
I've not really got a great deal of information about that, apart from the fact, I would support what you've just said about it being admirable that he did hold down that that position at the same time. But also, he is famed for being the person who began the custom of the royal walkabout. And I think that, what you said about him coming out of the castle early in the morning and greeting people was probably a precursor to that custom, and again something which shows him to be a man of the people, the sort of thing that somebody does when they're confident that they are regarded as being a good person by the general populace. And it's something that that can only actually happen and can only survive in a society that is monocultural and ultimately monoracial, because what happens is if you have a multicultural society, then you have rival factions within the country who are all competing for limited resources, and you have antagonisms that arise between different races. And we can see that nowadays with the great emphasis that there is throughout the media on racism, where every aspect of racism is talked about and analysed and ad nauseam, and where increasingly we see a world in which the leaders no longer feel safe amongst the crowds of their subjects. And one of the things that that struck me very powerfully many years ago was when the Popemobile had to be invented, with bulletproof screens so that people couldn't assassinate the Pope. And you read about the beast that is the car that the American president drives around in, which is which has got the same sort of armor that an armored car or a tank would have, and with special tires so they can't be fired at and deflated and all this sort of thing. And I think it's very sad that the Duke of Edinburgh, I suppose, invented this idea of the Royal Walkabout, because he lived at a time when Britain was a largely monoracial society, and where the general population could be trusted to support the royal family. But increasingly now we are in a period where the royals feel it's imperative to them that they organize security and have bodyguarding them, and where their exposure to the public is limited other than in a small number of engineered situations where, again, security can be ensured.
Yeah, you can look back at the pictures of this time, and all the faces are white, and he's just walking about in the morning. He comes out of the castle and walks about Windsor, and obviously without a huge security detail around him. I don't know, maybe going to the shops or whatever, and people were saying he used to come out at 10 o'clock every morning. And you can compare this with, or as you were saying about the beast that they have, that the President of America has, and the Popemobile that the Pope has. And then you can look at Xi Jinping in China, who lives in a monoracial country, and he travels about in a car, and he's stood up out of the top of the car, waving to all the people, and safe in the knowledge that nobody's going to try and pick him off, because it's a monoracial society that he lives in. And then you compare that to how things are today. Just have a look at America at the moment, with the White House surrounded by troops, as if they're protecting a junta there from a counter coup. And you can compare that to this time, when it was just safe for the Queen and a royal consort to just walk around the town in the mornings. It's a dreadful situation that we've ended up in. And as I say, it is a great shame that none of the royals have spoken up about it, but I guess that it comes under the heading of not interfering politically, something which Meghan seems to have broken with her promotion of feminism and multiculturalism. But none of them have really had anything to say politically up until that point because of this. Well, in 1956, the Duke founded the Duke of Edinburgh's Award in order to give young people a sense of responsibility to themselves and their communities. And in 1960, Philip attended the National Eisteddfod, wearing a long green robe, where he was initiated as an honorary ovate by the Archdruid of Wales. I can remember taking part in the Duke of Edinburgh's Award, and it's still going today. It had a lot of noble ideals. I think it started off and it was just for young men, and then they included young women, and for the women they had sort of things like learning how to be a good housewife, learning how to be a mother, all these sort of important things, and that falls under the heading of a sense of responsibility to themselves and to their communities. And the family is the centre of the community. It goes the family, the community, the nation, all an extended family, basically. And the idea of this, as you were pointing out earlier, Max, it ties in with the Scouts and their idea of being good people and doing keeping to your honour, being honourable people. And it also ties in with the Hitler Youth and the fascist youth that they had in Italy as well, this idea of you are obligated to do what you can for your community and to be a good person. It's something that Patriotic Alternative are working on today with the litter picking that they do, and the helping out the homeless and helping out old people. It's just this sense of being obligated to your community and giving out an award for those who were best at this and succeeded at this. Do you want to comment on the Duke of Edinburgh Award, Max?
Oh, just to say that I think that it's an admirable scheme, and I agree with you with regard to the Boy Scouts movement. Again, an admirable scheme, the sort of thing that's designed to develop self-sufficiency, self-reliance, independence, fitness, and enjoyment, and the preservation of the environment. All of these things are admirable things to work towards. And I would say that the Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme was a more modern English version of those same principles being put into practice.
A sort of holdover from the British Empire, wasn't it? When we wanted to instill in people a sense of duty to their people and to set a good example for everybody else. And it was really the last of it was the Prince of Edinburgh scheme. I dare say it's become all multicultural today, but it used to be just about doing your duty for your community. We'll move into sport next. He was a great sportsman. Philip played polo until 1971, when he started to compete in carriage driving, a sport which he helped to expand by writing the rule book and taking part in the supervisory committee. And he pretty much single-handedly invented this sport, really. It didn't really exist until he started it. And I was thinking today it must have been similar to chariot racing. You can imagine the kings of old and the royalty of old being involved in chariot racing. And then you've got Prince Philip here who starts up the sport of carriage driving, the modern equivalent of chariot racing. And he wrote the rule book. He tried to get it into the Olympics, but he failed at that. And they have all these courses that they go over. It's rather like a cross-country run, but taking place in a carriage with horses driving it. And it's quite a dangerous sport, actually, when the carriage can topple over. I saw an instance of that today. And he was also responsible for designing much of the technology that was actually used in the carriage driving, because he was an engineer as well. So he was a good all-round guy. This is what I mean. He was an alpha male, a very good example of an alpha male that was very good at everything, and also physically very, very fit, and quite an Aryan figure, actually. If you look at him when he was yeah, young, a perfect example of that.
And I think if you think back to what we said when we were going through the Greatest Britain series, and we were talking about the use of chariots by the ancient Britons in the wars that they had against the Romans, and the success they achieved in using chariots against the first two Roman invasions. And so that there has to be within the equestrians amongst our population, there must be a residual kind of chariot racing gene in their subconscious or whatever, somewhere deep down there, that Philip instinctively recognised and realised that he could develop and bring to the fore in creating an entirely new sport that used the same passions and the same skills that had perhaps laid dormant within our people for several hundred years, and that perhaps then is the key to the success of this form of racing.
Yeah, he certainly must have picked up on the fact that there was this has just been lying there dormant within the British for some time, this traditional sport that he could bring into the modern age and reinvigorate with carriages instead of chariots. And he was also a keen yachtsman, taking part in races and regularly attending Cowes Week with the Queen in Her Majesty's yacht Britannia. And he was also a keen pilot, taking his first airborne flying lesson in 1952. And by his 70th birthday, he had accrued 5,150 pilot's hours, and he was presented with his Royal Air Force wings in 1953. And he was a really keen yachtsman, and he would go out in small yachts where there was just two or three people on them, and he'd also be out out there in the Britannia as well. So flying as well. So he was taking place in sport in every way he possibly could, really. Taking part on the land, in the carriage races, at sea, in the yachts, and also enjoyed flying as well. And to be a pilot, again, you have to have a very high IQ. You have to be very alert. It's not a profession that just anybody can take up. You have to have perfect eyesight. You have to be incredibly fit, especially back then when you didn't have everything done by computer. You had to be aware of everything that the instruments were showing you. And to think that he was still flying in his 70s as well, that is quite something. Do you want to comment on him being a yachtsman here, Max, or a pilot?
Well, to be honest, I wasn't aware of the fact that he was the yachtsman, but I think it's something of a tradition, or has become such in recent generations, for members of the royal family to learn how to fly. Certainly for male members of the royal family to learn how to fly, and you can see that as far as flying is concerned, it is something which is quite exhilarating. And it's the sort of thing that you need to be a fairly wealthy person to actually a pastime to pursue. You have to be a fairly wealthy person to do that. And so he was ideally positioned in order to do that. And you're quite right in terms of the fitness that you need to have in order to hold a pilot's license. You have got to have perfect eyesight. You can't be colorblind. And pilots have to regularly undertake medical examinations, and if they develop certain medical conditions, then their ability to fly becomes limited, and sometimes with more severe illnesses, then they have to give up flying. So it is a mark of a man who was fit well into his late middle age, and again, that's something which is admirable and remarkable.
It must be very exhilarating. I mean, it is the sort of thing that you expect kings and princes to do, isn't it? Sort of fly about, jet about. I mean, it must be...
It's the sort of thing that you expect gods to do as well, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. That's the next bit that we're actually coming to. In 1974, the prince once visited a South Pacific island as part of a royal tour with the Queen. Islanders that were rowing the couple ashore believed the prince was the reincarnation of a warrior from a long time ago who had come down from the mountains and gone off to England in search of a bride. The bride is Mrs. Queen, so Philip is the god, they explained. For about 700 members of the Yeonanan tribe, he was not merely a royal, but a god descended from a local ancestral spirit that lived in the mountains of Tanna Island in the nation of Vanuatu. Since then, members of the Prince Philip movement, as they call themselves, reportedly prayed to framed photos of the prince daily, asking him to bless the banana and yam crops that they depended upon to survive. Village chief Jack Naiva told the Christian Science Monitor in 2007 that Philip is a god and not a man. Sometimes we hear his voice, he said, but we can't see him. And they've actually had to tell this tribe that he's unfortunately died, and there was a lot of mourning there. And he remained in contact with them. He would send them photographs of himself, and they have this shrine there that they pray to, for Philip to bless the banana and the yam crops. And they sent over a traditional Vanuatu battle club, and they sent a message with would he take a picture of himself with this battle club as well. So that's the origins of the picture that you see of him holding up this club, this spear thing, and then he sent that to them as well. I don't think he actually visited them after this, which is a shame. But I mean, how many people can you say are worshipped as a divinity over the other side of the world, and yet the Duke of Edinburgh was, Prince Philip was, and they literally do worship him as a god, and they were worrying about how they were going to tell their children that he had died. Because I guess sometimes divinities do die in the history, but they must be really cut up about this, as the royal family must be. You must have heard of this, Max. I recall it vaguely, this happening sometime in the past.
Yeah, I did hear about this before, and it's something that happened particularly during the period that Europeans were creating their colonies and their empires, that they would arrive at an island, or that they would venture into a part of Africa or South America where the people that lived there, the indigenous people, had never seen white people before, and where the indigenous people lived perhaps a Stone Age kind of existence with subsistence farming, where the only vehicle that they ever knew was a canoe. They perhaps went out in a canoe. Many people that lived in Africa and Southern America until Europeans went there had never ever seen a wheel, and never seen a wheeled cart. They just used to attach the side pieces, I'm not quite sure what they're called actually, on a chariot, the side pieces that the horses are strapped to. They just used to have those with some kind of a frame at the back that was just dragged along the ground. And for them to then suddenly see people arriving in ships that were enormous ships with massive areas of canvas, and then later with steamships that were producing smoke, and that could, where they could sail against the wind, and it didn't really matter which way the wind was blowing, and these ships were solid, made of steel, so they would have, it would have appeared as if that these large ships would have appeared to the natives of these small islands as if they were like the Death Star in the Star Wars films. It would just be this enormous metal impervious thing that comes, and then people come out of it. And the natural thing to think of if you are somebody that has been raised in the Stone Age culture is that the people that come out of this enormous metal thing that it seems impervious and omnipotent, that these people are gods. And especially if the people didn't arrive in a boat, but perhaps arrived by aircraft and flew down and then landed on the water, if it was a boat with floats, an aircraft with floats, etc. And so you can see how these people would have thought, crikey, you know, these people that are arriving, they look significantly different to us. You know, they're tall, fair ahead in many cases, fair skinned, and they've got this that they are, in terms of their engineering and in terms of their technology, so far ahead that it seems almost like light years ahead, almost as if they've come from a different planet, almost as if they're gods. And so you can see how easily it would be for the people of this remote place to decide that Prince Philip was a god. And I don't know perhaps how he felt about that. I should think he was probably quite flattered by it, first of all. But it would be difficult to know quite how to react, because if you then went and spent more time with the people, then the veneer would start to rub off. They would realise that actually you're not a god, you're just a man. And so therefore that would destroy the myth of his godhood. By not visiting, then that would tend to make him more remote from them, and that would perhaps, I don't know, tend to diminish their faith in him as their god. But it would appear that some of their tribe, at least, and perhaps even the majority of their tribes, still view him in that way. And I suppose it will be quite a shock to them to think that this person they've regarded as a god for all these years has actually died.
Well, he stayed in touch. He probably did the right thing then by not going to visit them. He would send them a picture of himself every year, and they would use these pictures in this shrine so they knew that he was still alive and over the other side of the world. And the legend was that this volcano god went to England in search of a wife, and that was an early miss, and they said that that was him. And you hear about these sort of things happening years ago in the New World when we first got to the Americas, but you don't think of it happening in the modern world. You don't think of it happening in the 1970s to a member of the British royal family. In April 2009, Philip became the longest serving British royal consort, and in 2013 he became the oldest ever male British royal and the third longest lived member of the British royal family. And it's a great shame that he didn't actually last another couple of months to make it to 100. And as I say, I should imagine that's why they didn't really concentrate that much on him on the television recently. They were probably waiting to do a big special on him for his birthday. So it's a great shame that he is gone, but it's given us a chance to look back over his life and actually to see a member of the royal family who did set a good example and who was a good representation of an alpha male. And I've got some comments that he made. I've got some quotes from him here, but do you want to say anything else about him before we move into these quotes, Max?
Well, just I agree with the things you've been saying, and I was very pleased to see that people were spontaneously leaving flowers outside of royal residences in his memory and in his honour, and which is only befitting, really, the role that he's played as far as Britain is concerned. As it is, you know, in my opinion, it is just such a shame that he had such great untapped potential that because of convention that he wasn't able to exercise.
Apparently a third of all the people in Britain had actually met him. He'd done so many public visits and walkabouts, and if the Queen wasn't able to go anywhere, then he would go there. And I think it's far more important an occasion, him passing away, than Princess Diana ever was. I can't recall being too fussed about that, but I've been quite moved by the fact that Prince Philip has actually passed away. You know, we haven't had a king pass. Well, I haven't had a king pass away in my lifetime. I'm sure you haven't either, Max. And this is probably the closest to it. It's something we read about in history, what would happen. And this is the closest we've got to it. Well, the prince was known for his colourful use of language at public events, and his numerous politically incorrect jokes have provided much delight over the years. And he would use this as a way of breaking the ice, I think. And people on the left were always attacking him for it. And there's also been some very shameful behaviour of people on the left over the weekend, where they've been cheering on the fact that he's passed away. But really, he was just trying to break the ice with people, I think. And he showed a sense of humour that I think most British people have, but they just don't dare to use it anymore. To a female sea cadet, he said, "Do you work in a strip club?" Obviously, he wasn't a feminist. He wasn't supportive of the Me Too movement. To expats in Abu Dhabi in 2011, he said, "Are you running away from something?" To multi-ethnic Britain's Got Talent 2009 winners Diversity, he said, "Are you all one family?" And this is quite a common one. He was often being attacked for the way that he spoke to people from different ethnicities. But really, I mean, he's just trying to break the ice. To the president of Nigeria, who was in national dress in 2003, he said, "You look like you're ready for bed." And he's quite a character. To a British trekker in Papua New Guinea in 1998, he said, "You managed not to get eaten then?" To Atul Patel at a reception for influential Indians in 2009, he said, "There's a lot of your family in tonight." So this is going on into the millennium, into the last 10 years. So this isn't just the sort of things that he said in the 70s. He's also said them recently. To the then Paraguay dictator, General Stroessner, he said, "It's a pleasure to be in a country that isn't ruled by its people." And I think that's a classic one, that one. To a Scottish driving instructor in 1995, "How do you keep the natives off the booze long enough to pass the test?" At a World Wildlife meeting in 1986, he said, "If it has four legs and it's not a chair, if it's got two wings and it flies but is not an aeroplane, and if it swims and it's not a submarine, the Cantonese will eat it." And that's a very true saying there. I've seen some horrific pictures of the things that the Cantonese will eat, sometimes while they are still alive, but it would only take Prince Philip to actually point it out. In Kenya in 1984, he said, "You are a woman, aren't you?" And it doesn't tell you whether it was a man or a woman that he actually said this to, but it can be difficult with blacks sometimes when they've shaved their heads, and it can be hard to tell whether they are male or female, particularly in the Maasai tribe. On Ethiopian art in 1965, he said, "It looks like the kind of thing my daughter would bring back from school art lessons." I mean, he really does call a spade, doesn't he? Yeah. In 1967, he said, "I'd like to go to Russia very much, although the bastards murdered half my family." Again, close to the bone there with what he is saying here. To Aboriginal leader William Brin in Queensland in 2002, he said, "Do you still throw spears at each other?" And these are, it's the sort of thing that people are going to be thinking, but they're just not going to say. And he just had this habit of actually saying what everybody else was thinking, I think. To black politician Lord Taylor of Warwick in 1999, he said, "And what exotic part of the world do you come from?" He's great, isn't he? When he was greeting crowds at Sandringham, the Duke of Edinburgh jokingly asked a bodyguard, "Is that a terrorist?" when he saw a man with a long ginger beard. After hearing President Obama had had breakfast with leaders of the UK, China and Russia in 2010, he said, "Can you tell the difference between them?" Which I think is brilliant, because it's so often said, isn't it, you can't tell the difference between black people. And you do wonder if with black people it's the same with them, and they can't tell the difference between people that aren't black. Again, but it would only take the prince to... ask this of President Obama after he's just had breakfast with the leaders of UK, China and Russia. On Princess Anne in 1970, he said, "If it doesn't fart or eat hay, she isn't interested." Of course, Princess Anne, very well known for her love of horses. In 1988, he said, "I don't think a prostitute is more moral than a wife, but they are essentially doing the same thing." Again, not a promoter of feminism, our prince. To a British student in China in 1986, he said, "If you stay here much longer, you'll go home with slitty eyes." To a Filipino nurse, as he unveiled a new cardiac centre at Luton and Dunstable University Hospital, he said, "The Philippines must be half empty. You're all here running the NHS." Again, another thing that people are going to be saying, there was actually 99 of these quotes, and I cut some of them out. And the other quotes that I've got are actually about journalists. But do you want to say anything about these quotes, Max? Have you got a favourite one of your own?
Well, I wouldn't say I've actually got a favourite one. I found many of those that you read out very funny. And you can imagine how he may well have said those, realising that they were fairly near the knuckle, and just sort of saying them with a wink in his eye just to create a bit of humor, because quite often, you know, if he was participating in quite a long diplomatic process that the Queen was kind of the central figure of, interacting with perhaps another head of state, that those occasions would have become fairly boring for him, really, because he was just there just in case he was called upon to help out. But a lot of the time he wouldn't have been called upon to do anything other than just to be there by the Queen's side. And so you can imagine his mind would just be spinning and thinking of all sorts of things that are perhaps tangential to the actual process that's going on. And then just this quip would come up, and he would say it to somebody who was stood by the side of him, perhaps equally bored as he might have been, and just in order to cheer the person up and to create something to laugh about. And it's just a shame that political correctness has kind of crept into everything nowadays, which again is another aspect of a multiracial and multicultural society. Political correctness then becomes inevitable, which then is something which kills spontaneous humour.
He's the last of the politically incorrect comedians, basically, that could get away with it in public life. You can just imagine him thinking, "Well, what can I get away with joking about here? Let's try this one," and really making a name for himself by doing it. As I said, he wasn't too impressed with journalists, and he does actually remind me of Donald Trump here. To the newsreader Michael Burke, when told that he knew about the Duke of Edinburgh's Gold Awards in 2004, he said, "Well, that's more than you know about anything else then." And you think that's 15 years ago, and he's pointing out that they're telling lies on the news, basically. To Simon Kellner, the Republican editor of The Independent at Windsor Castle reception, he said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I was invited, sir." And Philip said, "Well, you didn't have to come." And obviously The Independent is very much like The Guardian. It promotes this left-wing point of view. To a matron of a Caribbean hospital in 1966, he said, "You have mosquitoes, I have the press." So you think back then, 1966, what is that, 20, 50, 60 years ago, he was not impressed with the journalists and not impressed with the press. And finally, to a civil servant in 1970, he said, "You're just a silly little Whitehall twit. You don't trust me and I don't trust you." And I think that that really sums it up. I mean, it really does show that he was aware of what was going on, but he just really couldn't do anything to prevent it, I think. I think this shows that he knew that they were telling lies in the news. He knew that the politicians were not doing what they could for the people, but there just wasn't anything he could do about it. I mean, just look at the way you spoke to the civil servant here. "You don't trust me and I don't trust you." I mean, that's... Yes. It's really blatant there, isn't it? And I mean, I just think he was a really great man. It's a shame, as you say, Max, he really didn't get the chance to strike it out on his own. But at least he showed this example of humility and what you can still do, even when you are second, even when the person you are married to is more important than you. He still managed to carve out a place of his own by making these politically incorrect jokes. And he really did endear himself to the population by doing this. There were a lot of army members that had pictures of him on the wall and said that he was their hero. And it's just great that we did actually have a member of the royal family that we could be proud of, I think. I think we could be proud of the Duke of Edinburgh. I'm proud to say that I admire him for the things that he did, and I'm glad that we're able to pay tribute to him in this podcast that we do, which is obviously titled Real Britannia and is to do with Britain. And I'm just glad that we have a Britain that we can praise here, that is still alive, instead of a Britain that we are criticising for not doing the right thing. Max, have you got any final thoughts on the Duke of Edinburgh here?
Well, you can just imagine how annoying it would be to him that every aspect of his life would be commented on and would be interfered with by the civil servants and by the various courtiers, because you hear so much when you when the royal family is being discussed that courtiers that are there to be advisors take it upon themselves to instruct members of the royal family as to how they should behave, when in fact they should just be advising them as to what the correct procedure should be in a situation. And you can imagine that during the course of his life, he would have had many, many key points in his life, the experience of a bossy courtier or civil servant interrupting and saying, "Excuse me, you're not allowed to do that. You can't do that," and him just becoming, enraged by it all. Most of the time, he was able to bite his lip and control himself and not cause a scene. But as these quotes about journalists and civil servants demonstrate, there were occasions when he would let a little bit of the venom that he felt be known to the person who was provoking his anger.
I think he must have been quite frustrated, actually, at not being able to do more. As I mentioned earlier, he sort of made it his life's goal to try and preserve species and to speak out on behalf of the wildlife, because he couldn't speak out on behalf of the British people, because they're not allowed to do that. So he managed to find something that he could try to make a difference with. There is a quote where he said that if there was reincarnation, he would like to come back as a virus and help wipe out the human population. And that gets picked upon by people to say that he was evil. And that was just a joke. That was just in line with the rest of his quips that he made here. I think he was a genuinely good man, and I think he must have been quite disappointed, really, particularly with Harry, and wondering what happened to his children. Why didn't they take after him? And I think it's a great shame that he wasn't actually our king. I would have much preferred to have had Prince Philip as our king, and I think he would have done great things for the country if he had been. And I'm very, very sorry to see him go. I wished he'd actually made it to that 100th birthday, and we'd had a big celebration of it in the way that we're having a celebration of his life now. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. I think we should leave it there.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.